Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of The Oldie. And I'm delighted to be interviewing the great journalist and writer Hunter Davis, the only official biographer of the Beatles, the man who invented the Life in the Day column in the Sunday Times. He has written over 100 books. He's just turned 90. Most importantly, he's an Oldie contributor, and he's written a brilliant article in the new issue called Mustn't Grumble. And I've known Hunter quite a while, and he is not a grumpy old man. How have you avoided becoming a grumpy old man, Hunter?
Well, I was never a grumpy young man, so why should I change with being older? I think being older is brilliant. I love every day. I feel, obviously, I've had the usual aches and pains and heart bypass and knew this, that and the other. But my theory is that I have been young. The young have not been old. So I'm the winner.
And you do say in this great list of things, yeah, not to be grumpy, don't bang on about your ailments. Don't say it was better in the old days.
Yeah, I have a rule never to discuss my health or reveal anything except with people my age, because they're waiting for their chance to go on about that boring bad back. But people younger than you, that means 60, under 60, don't want to hear. Because they think if you're 90, obviously you're falling to pieces. So don't go on about it. So I never talk about my health.
And you don't say life is better in the old days. And unlike a lot of older men, you're not grumpy at younger people like me commissioning you to do articles.
The thing is, it's not the younger people, it's that they keep changing. So I have an editor or a publisher for 10 years, or an accountant, or I've outlived some, because I'm still working, I've outlived so many people. So all my contacts have long since retired. People who are my friends and my fans who run a publishing company, I ring them up and say, I've got this idea, what do you think? Piss off, stupid. Oh, no, that's brilliant, we'll do it. And it was straightforward. Now you have 13-year-olds in charge of acquisitions, and they don't know who you are, and they take so long, and they're part of empires. So the old days in journalism and the old days in publishing were definitely better, because we had independent publishers, and also there's so much money in newspapers. When I was on the Sunday Times in the 60s and 70s, we were overstaffed in many ways. People never got the sack. They just went on to Cuba for a few months on a non-existent jolly. And the expenses were very... So I feel sorry for... That is one way things have got worse.
Yeah, but very hard for a young journalist to start now and survive, isn't it? Yeah.
And they're so badly paid these days. Well, I've got a daughter as a writer, and she's doing often the same sort of books I did 30, 40 years ago, and she's getting bugger all for them.
Yeah, but you, again, you never complain about this when you get the not very princely sums from the oldie. You never say, pay me double or I'm not going to do this.
I'm grateful to see my name in the Oldie, my favourite magazine in the whole world. Stop twisting my arm, Harry.
As you say, you've had some pretty rough times. Your late wife, the writer Margaret Forster, died almost exactly 10 years ago. Yeah. And that was bloody awful. But still, you get on with life all the same.
We went to school together. She was my childhood sweetheart. And I missed her dearly. She was, the best moment of my life was meeting her. I think I changed completely. I had such confidence when I met her because she was so clever and brilliant and good at everything. Whereas I was just...
But you were, as you were described in an interview with Valerie Grove in the Oldie, you were a very enthusiastic young boy, first in Scotland and then Carlisle. You were born with your glass half full, is that fair enough?
Realised at the time, but I was a little boy age 4 in Scotland, in Renfrew. Apparently, I used to go to the front gate, lean over the gate age 4 and stop total strangers in the street and say, hello, my name is Hunter. What's your name? where are you going? My mummy and daddy were in and started having a row. Whereabouts are you going? And I would talk to people all the time and hide nothing.
And that's continued ever since. I see you near Hampstead Heath, where we both live.
And obviously having rejections on books. I've had 100 books published, but I've had 100 books turned down at least that I thought were brilliant. And these stupid publishers said no. So you just
But you get on with it. You don't dwell on it.
You bounce back.
Yeah.
Or you think a new version of doing it.
Yeah. And you began as a very successful journalist. Your most famous contribution, the Life in the Day column, you had actually come up with at Durham University. Is that right?
When I was a student, I was editing the student newspaper. And I did this column, which was a made-up column. I'd actually spent my time drinking, chasing girls and having... playing Shovhaveney, and I'd done nothing, but I became the advertising manager of, it was called Palatinate, the Durham University paper, and I went in one day with the adverts, and there's a hole in the page, and I heard the editor say, oh, how are we going to fill it? We're going to press in a couple of hours, and I found myself saying, I will fill it for you, and I'd never written a thing in my life. I was age 19. I'd gone to school with some very clever people who did the school magazine, which I didn't do. So I went home and I'd been to a boat club dinner. The college I was at Durham was a rather posh college, and we had lots of boat club parties, and I'd been to a dinner and threw oranges in medieval windows. And I wrote A Day in the Life, got up, was sick out of window, sick spelt like Just William, S-I-K, went down to hall, threw another orange through the window, was sick again, and it was just silly of a day in the life of a book club party in funny spelling. And everybody thought it was lovely. And the next week I did The Day in the Life of a Science Student. Then I did a dom. I pretended to be these people and a science student. And I called it A Life in the Day.
Brilliant twist,
which is my idea of turning around A Day in the Life. That was 10 years before the Beatles did the same thing. And I went on from there to be featured, and then I edited the paper. So I then became editor of the paper, and it inspired me not to be a teacher, which I thought I assumed I'd do to please my mother. So I joined a graduate training scheme, which is called Thomson News, it was called Kemsley. It was the Sunday Times one, and we had newspapers all over the UK, including in London. And so 10 years later, I was editor of the Colour magazine, and Harry Evans was the editor of the whole paper.
Who was a brilliant editor, was he?
Wasn't he the most brilliant editor? After you, Harry.
Yeah.
But he was at the same college as me, at Durham, and he edited the same paper 8 years earlier. I never met him. And actually, I came to London before he came. And he came to visit me in London when he was editing the Darlington paper, where he was, the Northern Echo, where he was made crusading journal. And he came down and he had an interview with the Sunday Times, and I was the only person he knew in London. I said, what's the interview for? And he said, to be managing editor. I said, managing editor what? Managing editor news, sport, features. He said, nothing. I said, that means managing editor, fuck all. Unless you're a space baron. In fact, Harry, you're a provincial journalist, I would stay in the Northeast.
And he took your advice.
He took the job
and
became editor. So he was editing the whole paper, and he had a problem with the Colour magazine. People were saying there's too many adverts and not enough copy in it. And he wanted the back of the magazine opened up. And he wanted, at the time, 1972 or whatever, it used to finish on 20 pages of adverts and no editorial. He said, we want a self-contained, simple, one-page editorial with one simple image, and we could sell the op-ed page advertise double the rate. So my first idea was a column called Hometown, and we interviewed famous people about their hometown.
Yep, good idea.
And I took Eric Morecambe, back to Morecambe.
Fantastic.
And did him there.
Was he very charming, I hope?
Yeah, it was lovely. Yeah. Then I took Edward Heath back to where? Broadstairs.
There you are.
And it ran for about 6 weeks, but we couldn't keep up the quality. So you had to get the journalist and you had to get the famous people. And it was too labour intensive. So I then binned it after 6 weeks. We're not doing that. And I had another column called Sacred Cows. And this was journalists, that was a bit easy to do, in which the case, they did, whatever, 1,000 words, rubbishing a sacred cow.
That's a good
or
idea.
Raving, yeah. Or raving about something that they've really, I think somebody raved about Terry Wogan, and somebody, we've got some really good writers. But after 6 weeks, the tone became the same. People preferred rubbishing.
Yeah, and that gets boring,
my,
yeah.
My idea was you, some week it would be praising something. And then I thought of this idea, very simple, of an old, the idea was it would be famous people and unknown people. And I came to an editorial meeting, I had a massive staff and a massive budget. And I said, I've got this new idea. It could be a day in the life of somebody from breakfast, and you'll ask them when they wake up, who did they sleep with last night? Hoping they'll tell you something good. I slept with my wife, or I slept in a hotel. What did you have for breakfast? And what are you, when did you decide what clothes you're putting on? And I said, I'll just take somebody at random. And I picked him on the chief sub. It was the most boring chief sub. And he wore the same suit, as far as we could see. I said, Patrick, let's see it's you. And we got to the question, he said, oh, I decide what I'm wearing to work by looking in my diary. Oh, because in a calendar month, I don't wear the same outfit twice, which was bollocks. Because it all, he has different socks on or a different tie, and I change it. And they all said, you've got it.
Right, yeah. And it's still going 70 years
old. Well, anyway.
Yeah.
And first person I did, no, when I left the paper, because in the Durham one, I made them up. The last one I did personally was Guy the Gorilla.
Brilliant idea.
I went to the zoo. I interviewed Guy the Gorilla with his... So I knew what time he got up.
Yeah.
I knew which gorillas he fancied and was shagging.
Yeah.
What he has for breakfast and his moods.
Brilliant idea. Did you, from your first day in journalism, realise this is a wonderful job?
I adored it. I left in 1970. I've been a freelance when I... But Harry wanted me to come back. But my best fun in life, apart from editing the student paper, Harry brought me back to edit what was the women's pages. This was in 19-whatever, and Harry had a problem with the older readers that might remember it. There was a grand dame who was a fashion and women's editor called Ernestine Carter. She was an old bat. And she wouldn't do anything modern. She wouldn't do domestic stuff, and she only did clothes you could buy in Harrods. And they couldn't get rid of her because she was a great person in the trade. So Harry thought of the idea would have another section called the Look Pages. We call them the Look Pages, but these are really the women's pages.
Right.
And he made me the editor. And when I sat down the first day at the office, Mark Boxer was sitting there. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm editing his page. I said, no, you're not. Come and see Harry. Oh, sorry, I forgot to tell Mark he's not doing it. Next day I came in and Molly Parkin was sitting there.
Who's just died, yeah.
I said, what are you doing? She said, I'm the... And I said, no, yeah. So I went to see Harry again, and she was the fashion editor. And Harry said, I'm giving you a new columnist called Jilly Cooper, and you'll be in charge of her. She's done one piece for the magazine, which the readers loved, and she'll be your columnist. So Molly was the fashion editor. We had a woman called Lucia van der Post,
yep,
who did domestic stuff and household thing.
Dear Jilly Cooper, who was a great contributor to the Oldie, was also a brilliant journalist, brilliant columnist, wasn't she?
Yeah. She did it for a couple of months, and they were a bit the same tone. Jolly hockey stick, public school girl, ha ha ha, in an office with the girls. And I said, it's best to be funny and witty when you have a real life, real story to be funny about. And I took her out to lunch, and I discovered that Leo was she was the second wife of Leo. And she talked about being a second wife. I said, do that. Do a column about being a second wife. You can make it funny. You can have all your silly puns. And I got her to go to rugby matches to watch Leo Payne and raving about the thighs of all the people.
And had to talk again about you being a journalist. I've just handed you your article from the Oldie. Do you get the same pleasure now, aged 90, at seeing your name in print as you did aged 20?
I can't wait to sit and read it.
Yeah,
I love it.
It's a thrill, isn't it? And it's some people call it an addiction to writing, an addiction to journalism.
I mean, there was a time a few years ago I was doing 5 regular columns. I've just lost my Sunday Times job, which I did for 25 years.
The money one. Money very one. Good, yeah.
Bastards. Ageist. I've lost the New Statesman football column. I did that for 30 years. A new editor's taken over. I've still got Saga. Cumbria Life, I gave up. You know why?
Yeah.
I was taking longer to do my invoices because they get taken over by a group. And it was all codes. And you had to fill your form in. I said, I'm giving it up.
But you've got a crucial element of a journalist is being able to write about anything. When I saw you a couple of years ago, you just had some operation. Said, oh, I'm so sorry, Hunter. He said, no, it's great. Yeah. 2 articles in the Mail and 1 in the New Statesman.
Yeah. No, everything is copy.
Yeah.
But if I don't, I don't deserve a drink. And I drink a whole bottle of Sauvignon Blanc a day, unless I've done at least 1,000 words. At least I do a column.
Brilliant, yeah.
And I'm lucky, I still have 1 column in Saga magazine, and I've got these 2 books commissioned.
Which we'll come into in a moment. But first, Hunter, you had possibly the break of the century as you became the Beatles' one and only official biographer. When and how did that happen?
When I took over my first job in the Sunday Times was a boy on the Atticus column. The Atticus column was a diary column. And people like Sir Chevrel Sitwell, Ian Fleming, John Buchan edited this column. It was an old-fashioned column about who will be the next Bishop of Durham, who will be our next man in Washington. It was like a telegraph column. And Bob Robinson took it over, and I was his boy.
The famous Robert Robinson. Yeah.
And I was dying to do my heroes, like footballers, pop stars, Mary Quant, designer. This was the early 60s, and it was still very old-fashioned. But I eventually took it over, and I interviewed George Best, and I did John Brain, gritty northern novelist. I didn't do any of the posh people we'd been doing before. And Eleanor Rigby, it's 1966, Eleanor Rigby had just come out. And when I heard the words of it, I thought, it's brilliant. Puts on her face, which she keeps in a jar by the door. That was a lad with a background like mine, a council house, a grammar school in the north. And he was writing this most beautiful poetry. And in the piece I said, it'll be the best poetry of 1966. And I got a fan letter from the star writer, Kenneth Tynan, on our rival paper, The Observer. He said, I agree with you. The words are brilliant. So I went to see Paul in his house.
St. John's Wood.
Miles away. And I did the piece about him. I explained the whole background.
And what was he like then?
He was lovely. I went into his house and over his fireplace was a Magritte. I thought, how is a boy, 1920, who never went to college, he went to a good grammar school, knows about Magritte? I knew about him roughly because I'm very cultured and educated.
Yeah.
Oh, he was lovely and charming. He was living on his own. He had a housekeeper and he was stuffing his face with a fried breakfast. He denies it now when I see him. 6 months later, I, by this time, had written 3 books. And my first novel, Here We Go Around the Mulberry Bush, was being turned into a Hollywood film. Did you ever see it, Harry?
Well, I didn't, no.
You're too young.
Yeah.
And I was writing the screenplay, and the director hoped that Paul would write the theme tune. So 6 months later, I went to see Paul again with a different hat on. I was now the screenplay writer. And the director, Clive Donald, He said he was interested, but in the end he didn't do it. But we had brilliant music in it. We had Stevie Winwood, Spencer Davis, and Traffic did the music. Brilliant
Pretty
film.
Good, yeah.
The script was rubbish by me. And while I was with Paul at that meeting in his house, talking about something else, my film, I said, you know, there should be a proper hardback book about the Beatles. There have been only two books about the Beatles at the time, both little skittery paperbacks. One a fan club book, and one written by an American journalist on tour with them in America. I said, if you do a proper biography for the rest of your life, this is 1966, when people ask you the same boring questions, such as, why is Beatles spelt that funny way? Nobody asks that question today. Or why have you got that funny haircut? You could say. And he sat me down, because he's a PR, and he helped me write a letter to Brian Epstein. He told me to show off about my Sunday Times thing and my two books. And I went to see him in Chapel Street in Belgravia. And he was only 2 years older than me, but he was so sophisticated. He cancelled twice. We didn't know, the world didn't know about his homosexuality.
Yes. Did he seem like a tortured soul at all?
Not really, yeah. But he was a masochistic gay man who picked up boys who weren't gay, scaffolders and everything else, and soldiers, would get them to his home, give them drinks and drugs, get them into bed, and then they would beat him up. And that was his pleasure, being beaten up.
Yeah.
He'd then have 3 days on drugs and sleeping pills, because they would usually steal something, full of remorse, and he cancelled 3 times. Now, the boys roughly knew about it. I think the real attraction to him of the Beatles was John, because John was the macho of people.
You're sort of in love with John, would you say?
No, but they had a sort of one-night stand, mutual masturbation in Spain, which I couldn't write in the book. But as the years went on, people in the business knew he was gay, and they thought he must have fancied Paul, because Paul was the pretty one. But it was John he fancied. So I saw Brian, and I went to see him, and he agreed immediately to the book, and we agreed the deal, which was £3,000. No, the publisher. The publisher was Heinemann, and I had trouble getting it accepted, because one of the directors of Heinemann said, oh, not the Beatles. This is 19. We know everything we'll ever want to know about them.
Amazing.
Secondly, the bubble will burst. I said no. And they said, pop music doesn't sell. This is social history. When I was in Brian's house, he played me an acetate. Acetate was a proof of a record. And it was Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields. And he played it to me. When I heard Strawberry Fields, I thought, that is absolutely incredible. Every album the Beatles had produced so far was a development. It moved on, different instruments, different music. And I half thought the publishing director was right. Something else will come along. They're finished. When I heard Strawberry Fields, I realised they're still developing.
And in terms of their
anyway, I just
characters.
Finished it off.
Yeah, go on, go on.
So Brian, without being asked, he said, I'll tell you what, I'll put a clause in the contract, this is 1966, whereby I will not give permission for any other writer to have access to the Beatles for 2 years after your book comes out. This is 66. My book came out in 68, and nobody else could write about the Beatles till 70. And what happened by 1970? They didn't exist. So the whole of the time I was doing the book, I never knew I was going to be the only authorised biographer who had access to them all. So I was in Abbey Road during the whole of Sgt. Pepper. Amazing.
It's amazing. And in terms of their characters, in the very good film a couple of years ago about them in the studio, Paul comes across as the organised one. Is that right? Can you paint a picture of each of their characters?
Yeah. No, Paul was the PR one. Paul was the charming one, and Paul was really, in a way, the calculating one. You'd be very hard to con Paul or rip him off, whereas John didn't care. And George was in the clouds, and Ringo was a nice, straightforward lad.
John, quite contrary, comes across on TV.
John had a very short attention span. Paul was so hard working. When I was in Abbey Road listening to them playing, I would be bored rigid, hearing the same thing going over and over. Paul would make them do it for 100th time. And I thought it was right the first time, they made them do it again. Whereas John got bored very quickly.
And George and Ringo seem in that documentary to defer. There's a great bit where George just goes, just tell me what you want me to do to Paul,
George,
and I'll do it. And Paul
off.
Says, look, someone's got to be in charge and make sure everyone's here on time. And that's what happens.
It is amazing that these four boys should be born and brought up a couple of miles from each other. And three of them, three, being so creative. And they're not just creative, they could do everything. George, John and Paul could sing, play and write. I mean, Rodgers and Hammerstein, Gilbert and Sullivan. One of them did the words, or Lloyd Webber. Lloyd Webber doesn't do words. Elton John doesn't do words. But the Beatles, those three, did the words. And we know eventually that if it was a Penny Lane, Paul had written every one.
And Ringo was wrongly mocked, would you say? I mean, a very good drummer.
He was an important part of it. He did eventually write some, but he was the straight man.
Yeah. And you also had this extraordinary access, because at the end of the day in Abbey Road, there were these little bits of paper with some lyrics on them. They turned out to be the lyrics to which songs?
Yeah. What happened was that while I was doing the book, I spent the first six months not interviewing them. I hung around their houses socially. I was in Abbey Road listening to them playing, but I didn't do up against the wall, tell me your first memory. I didn't do any hard interviewing. I went back to Liverpool to meet their mums and dads, all of whom, they'd moved into posh houses, and it was a very strange, it's the words of thing, father of the man. The child had become father of the man. The children were in charge of the parents. And I only met that 20, 30 years later, meeting Wayne Rooney's parents and Gazza, when the children become multimillionaires and buy the houses, and the parents are in it. And they're scared to speak out of line.
How amazing. And John's mother had obviously died. You talked to Aunt Mimi, didn't you?
Yeah, I went down to see Aunt Mimi.
Yeah.
So I also went to Hamburg and met Astrid, who did their haircut and their clothes. So when I came back to see the Beatles, I said, guess what? I've just been to Hamburg. And they hung on my every word. And I used that as a way of talking to them. Can you remember your first time in Hamburg? How many times did you go? I went to Astrid's house. Can you remember it? So I knew so much. And I went, when I went back and met Pete Best working in a bakery for tuppence an hour, I said, I've been to see Pete Best. They changed the subject.
Because they felt embarrassed or they didn't like him?
They were still embarrassed, him, not just by sacking him. They didn't do it face to face. So I spent all this, I went back retracing the steps.
And you could ask them anything. Did they have copy approval, did they?
They all read it. George wanted more on Indian mysticism and spiritual. I said, save it for your own book. Paul had no comments. John had no comments. But by chance, his Aunt Mimi read the manuscript, which was lying in his house. And she read the chapter on his childhood where he's talking about pulling girls' knickers down and saying fucking this and rows. She said, he never swore as a child. I said, Mimi, this is his memory. You went at primary school with him. I can't change it. He's read it. This is his memories of being a boy. But he wasn't like that. He was as happy as the day was long. So I put in the last sentence in that childhood chapter, and Aunt Mimi's memory was John was as happy, and that kept her quiet. That was the only correction. Later on in New York, long after the book was up, John gave an interview to Rolling Stone, and he said, and he was asked by the editor of Rolling Stone, whose name will come to me, wasn't that a wonderful book that Hunter did? And John said, it was a whitewash. And I was absolutely furious. I rang him up in New York and he said, you know me, Hunt. I just say everything. He said, what I meant was, you didn't have all the sex all the orgies in the on tour, and in the bedrooms and in the change rooms in the hotels and the stadiums. I said, how could I write all that when you're all happily married? And I was meeting your wives and your girlfriend. And I said, anybody who was an elder in those days knew about groupies. Nobody had actually written. I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
He said, yeah, I know, I was just saying it.
And you weren't intimidated by them? Here you were talking to the foremost people in the foremost famous people in the world. You
no,
weren't intimidated?
I felt in tune with them because of their background. I'd been to exactly the same sort of grammar school, and my fantasy in life at the same age as John was to have a rally, Lenten, sports, with a Stormy Arc. We had the same. We listened to Dick Barton, we read Justwell. I knew all their terms of reference, even though I was 2 years older than Ringo. I still knew all, and as you know, they're just blokes. All famous people are just blokes. And you know they have their phobias and everything. And they didn't shout at their staff.
Good
they
sign,
didn't,
yeah.
They weren't nasty. And they weren't, they brought up the book I'm doing now, Get Back.
Well, I was about to say,
is social history.
John, Paul, George, Ringo and me, it's about your relationship with them.
Yeah, so I alternate, if that's the right word, five people. So I have John being born, then I have the others being born, and the air raid in the background, and then I have me being born. So I take you through the five people, chapter by chapter, until Love Me Do. That's the break. I don't do the Fab Four. It's only their childhood and the Quarrymen. And it's the same with me. I take me up to when I met them, which I've just told you the story.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And
I, every time at a stage when we have, Ringo was in hospital for 18 months, but for the National Health Service, he wouldn't have got free operation. So I then tell you the history of the National Health.
Right.
When the 11 plus comes up, I explain the 11 plus.
Right.
When we have rationing, so I do all the things that were changing at the time without being lumps of concrete, without doing Wikipedia.
Yeah.
I explain the social things that were happening, the war. Because John and Ringo were both born during air raids. And I have memories of the air raid shelters. And we all have memories of rationing.
It's obviously very powerful. Bill Wyman addressed an oldie lunch the other day.
Yeah.
And he's completely obsessed with the war. Of course.
It
would be, yeah.
It had a great effect on him. And I didn't do this too overtly, but I think with Paul, their waste not, want not, and their hard workingness came from the war and the discipline.
And Hunter, one of the great things about you, you're very honest about money. Mm. You must have made a huge fortune out of that book, didn't you?
Not really. I bought my mum and dad a house each. And we bought Margaret's mum and dad a house. And none of the money came from the Beatles then. Margaret and I had a Hollywood film each. Margaret did, her first novel was called Georgia Girl and became a massive hit, bigger than mine. And she did the script. And I did Mulberry Bush, and from memory, I got £20,000 for Mulberry Bush. So I had, as it were, a capital before the Beatles book came along. And the Beatles book was only 3,000 advance. It was only when it started, when the book came out, and everybody around the world wanted the rights to it, that it...
You had a royalty, did you?
Yeah. I've forgotten. Yeah.
I
shared it with the... But it's my copyright. It was my book. In fact, it's written in my words. I later did ghostwriting, like Gaza and John Prescott. But this was my book.
And Hunter, what were the song lyrics you picked up off the floor?
Right. So when I was with them in the very beginning, I would say, I'm going to retrace your steps over the next 2 years. Could you give me some examples of your handwriting? So when people say, I got this letter from John when he was 10, I'll say, bollocks, that's not a thing. And they gave me, when I was in Abbey Road, they were working on songs, and they'd often leave a song for 6 months. So I'd listen to the song, and at the end of the session, at 2 a.m, I think they're going to record this. And I didn't know they... And I'll be writing about this in the book, and I would say, can I have a copy of the words? Because I heard it, and Ringo would come in late, and they would say to Richie, he was called, this is what we're doing tonight, Richie, and they'd give him the handwritten words. And at the end of the session, the words would be lying on the floor, and they never picked it up. These are lads in their early 20s. The whole point of being in the recording studio is to record. And George Martin's been twiddling the knob, so why would they want to keep the words? That was their mentality. There's no interest in bits of paper, scraps of paper. So I'd pick them up off the floor, and I used them in the book. Some are used in the book, some are referred to in the book, because these songs had not been finally completed, and we hadn't heard them on an album for 6 months later. After the book was all over, I had them on my wall, and I had lots of letters from John and Paul and postcards, and I kept all this stuff. And I then thought, well, my kids became teenagers, some stupid drunkard will nick them. And then I thought, I'll give them to the nation. And I rang the British Museum, first of all, and I thought they might turn it down. They just turned down Graham Greene's archives by his grandson, who was at the BBC, and he had to give it to the Bodleian. They said, try the Bodleian. And the British Museum said, brilliant. And a year later, when the British Library opened, I turned out to have nine original handwritten lyrics.
Including which songs?
Yesterday. Yesterday is a cheat, but Paul has kindly asked my permission to use my... Love Me Day, Love Me Do, nobody's ever seen the handwritten version, because they did it in the words of Bernal, and he hasn't got a copy of... But when I was with him, he wrote out Yesterday for me, and put at the end, Paul McCartney, 9 out of 10, see me. And that is in the... When the Queen opened the British Library in whatever, she spent 2 minutes looking at Magna Carta and about 10 minutes reading the words of Yesterday, because it's beautifully handwritten. All the other ones I've got, like, I've got a list of them somewhere, are the original corrections. I've done this book called The Beatles Lyrics. That's my proudest book, The Beatles. Anyway, when I got my OBE X years ago, you know how it works. You're allowed free people. Hasn't your dad got one of these? No?
He hasn't, no.
You will have it soon. And it's in Buckingham Palace. You don't know till the day, so we're all saying, oh, please God, it's not Prince Andrew or Princess Anne. It was the Queen. So you go forward, and a lackey says, this is Hunter Davis. He's a writer. So, you're told, call her ma'am, call her your majesty, and then call her your ma'am for the rest of the interview. And the minute she shakes your hand, that is the end. You turn and leave. And you don't ask her any questions. And you get 30 seconds each. So she says to me, you're a writer. You've just been told. I said, yeah. Do you remember when you opened the British Library? And you're not so bad. Yes, I do. If it's not, I said, do you remember reading the words of Yesterday? Yes, I do. It's fascinating. I said, that copy belongs to me. What? I said, I did the book. And I gave it to... Oh, that is, and she laughed and she laughed. Right, there's 100 people getting CBEs and knighthood. And there's a big audience. And the Scots Guard are playing South Pacific all the way through in the background. And all the mums and dads are there. And the only time she laughed or smiled or showed any expression during the 100 people getting awards was for me. And they all rushed forward and said, what did you say? I said, I'm too tired. It'll take so long. And that was what it was.
Very good.
Yes, I do.
And he became a very good friend of Paul McCartney. You went on holiday with him here in this very house in North London. You possess a pair of his Speedos.
I still got them. Well, he's swimming. He stayed with us in a house we'd rented in Portugal for 2 weeks, out of the blue. 68, the year after I did the book, I went abroad for a year because my children were very small, not at school. And we rented the house, and it was December. And I had no telephone or email. This is 68. And out of the blue, in the middle of the night, there was a knock at the front door. And Paul was there with a big beard. And this blonde American we've never seen in our life before, 6 months earlier, when we'd been back in London, he was engaged to Jane Asher. And I thought she was lovely. I thought they were a lovely couple. And we thought this girl, Linda, American, was a groupie, a one-night stand. But she had a child, and they just met. And Paul thought, let's go and see Hunter. We've got his address. And you could play with his children. He'd been to this house loads of times. So he'd met my children. He's lovely with children. So they stayed for 2 weeks. And we got to know Linda. And he left very late at night from St. John's Wood. At the last minute, he got his cosy. He brought his guitar. He brought a £20 note. And he brought a bottle of whiskey for me. And they came on a private plane. And they arrived at Farah Airport, which had not long opened. And he's standing there in an empty airport. He has my address. He doesn't know I'm 80 kilometres from Faro. And he eventually sees some sort of official. And he says, can you change this money into local currency? Right, Harry, what was the local currency in Portugal in 1968? You've got 3 seconds. One, two,
escudo.
Well done. So he gives the £20 note to this official-looking man who goes off with the cash. And while he's there, he says, a man with a taxi cab name on it. He says, taxi, and he jumps in the taxi, gives him my address with no money. And so they drive for an hour and a half to my house. He stupidly reveals to the taxi driver the person he's going to see doesn't know he's coming. And secondly, he's got no money.
So taxi driver know who he was?
No. So they stayed for 2 weeks. Anyway, one evening, it's the last story, my voice is good. One evening, he used to go to the lavatory with his guitar. And he came back. We had a conversation sitting down with the children in bed. He loved talking to Margaret, because Margaret was a very strong, clever woman. Would tell him that's absolutely stupid. I've never heard such a stupid idea. That's so banal. Paul tried to think of something. She put him in his place, like a sixth form gathering. And it came out in the conversation that evening, my first name is not Hunter. I've done it, that piece I did for you. My first name is Edward. And he had hysterics. He thought it was so funny. I said, you need to laugh, because your first name is not Paul. What's his first name?
Can't do it.
James. He's called James Paul McCartney after his dad. He goes to the lavatory and he comes back and plays me a song he's just written, which goes as follows. I can't sing. There you go, Eddie, Eddie, Eddie. There you go, Eddie, Eddie, you've gone. And I thought it was brilliant. I thought, God, I hope he finishes it. And it's on the next album. It wasn't, but in the outtakes for Let It Be and also the anthology, they did finish the song and you could hear him singing it to John in the studio. And he has an extra verse, which is not very complimentary with me. The second verse goes, you think you are one of the in crowd. You think you are one of the boys. You think you are blah, 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 or whatever. If you go on YouTube and put in Paul McCartney singing There You Go, Eddie, you can hear the completed song.
And he also did you the favour of leaving his swimming trunks behind.
Well, after he'd gone, we found under his bed his swimming costume. We were still in Portugal. And I wrote and said, "You idiot, you left your swimming costume." It was so hard posting things in those days. He said, "Bin it, chuck it up." So we didn't, we kept it. And I've still got, when he dies, I'm going to get the DNA out and clone lots of little Paul McCartneys. Don't tell him that.
And Hunter, we must draw to a close, but you've just turned 90. You're having a birthday party
soon.
Five birthday parties. And at one of them, you're going to recite a poem of your own composition. Yeah, can you recite it to us now?
Yeah. Oh, God. It's quite long.
That's all right.
I thought you might want to print it.
Well, let's hear what it's like.
I'm afraid my agent will...
The normal 10%.
It's really in reference to Jenny Joseph, her famous poem, "When I am an old woman, I will wear purple." I thought I'll do it for me. "When I'm an old man, I will wear pink." I wear pink all the time, by the way. You haven't seen my pink. Look, my pink trousers. "When I'm an old man, I will wear pink and not give a damn what people think. I won't care. It's not suitable for my age to moan and groan and get in a rage. I will expect respect to be called Sir and Mister, possibly Your Worship. Go on about my bad knee and worse hip." How's that for a rhyme with worship?
Very good.
"And my triple bypass, would you like to see the scars? And my latest sample, look, I've got some in these jars. Don't I deserve a round of applause? Now that I'm 90, perhaps three cheers. And total silence, shh, whenever I'm speaking. Fanfares and trumpets for lasting all these years. I won't bother about the soup stains on my pulley, or that my Primark trainers do rather stink. My pink baseball cap does look awfully silly, and I always say yes, I will have another drink. On bus and tube, no matter who I meet, I expect at once to be given a seat, and slyly kick all the yappy dogs and other old people, stupid sods. As a child, I'd never seen a banana. There was a war on, don't you know? Times were hard. Don't get me started. And no, I'm not going to apologise just because I've farted. I'm always right, so please don't contradict. And I don't care if you predict. You've heard this story loads of times before. I'll repeat everything, say what I think, and do hurry up, I want that drink. I buy second hand, Poundland, here I come. Nothing new, really, or just very little. But I'm totally distraught they've closed Kentish Town Lidl. 10 times a night I have to get up, not alas to tend to a hottie, but to work out exactly where the hell is my potty. I ignore all sell-by dates, eat mould on strawberries and out-of-date chicken, and take to my bed if I'm suddenly stricken. And there I will mutter a happy song, clutching a glass of my best Sauvignon. I don't wear hairy aids, accuse others of shouting, and my walking stick's a misnomer. It's me what does the walking. I'm forever trying to find my specs, and now tell me, I've forgotten, what on earth was sex? I will dance at all parties till I fall over, embarrass my granddaughters and refuse to drink water, go and live on a barge, though it never sails, and flirt with pretty young women who cut my toenails. Now I'm old, so I'm told, but I've also been young. But the young have not been old, so I reckon I'm the winner!
That's absolutely it. Brilliant. And thank you so much for the great Hunter Davis for appearing on Radio Oldie at the age of 90. You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.